Just to usher in the month of Sivan, just a few days away from Chag HaShavuos, of course, thoughts are turned towards the Chag. And I would like to devote our remarks this evening to Chag HaShavuos. To begin with a matter of minhag, a number of minhagim that accompany Shavuos. As far as halachas are concerned, it has the halachas of Yom Tov. But it doesn't have special mitzvahs in the sense that Pesach has matzah and Sukkot has sukkah and abaminim. Of course, it's associated with the mitzvah of Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, but it does have minhagim. And one of the well-known minhagim that relate to Shavuos is that of having greenery in the shul. And there are a number of ways of understanding what this is all about and what its sources are. It can be based in Rishonim, perhaps even earlier than that. It is not a result of a grassroots movement, one may say. And so, the Ramah, in Hilchos Shavuos, in Siman Taf Tzadik Dalet, so he quotes this minhag, Lishtoach asavim, to have greenery, shrubbery, grass, etc., asavim, in shul, zecher lematan Torah, as a commemoration of matan Torah. So firstly, the source of Maharal, pardon me, the source of the Ramah here is the Maharil, not to be confused with Maharal. The Maharil, Rabbeinu Yaakov Molin, one of the great sources really of Minhagim, of Ashkenazi Minhagim, one of the Rishonim, quoted extensively in the Ramah, and he says that it's zecher lematan Torah. The question is, how is grass zeicher lematan Torah? Well, the Levush explains that we're told that in honor of the occasion of the giving of the Torah, Har Sinai, and Sinai, of course, is in the middle of the desert, and it's not much growth there, but Har Sinai became covered with pasture, covered with greenery. So any picture of Har Sinai at Matan Torah, Har Sinai should be green, even if all the other mountains around it are brown or whatever. And the source of this, actually in the Torah, the way we may infer this, is because there was a special injunction that none of the animals could graze by the mountain. Kamatzon babakar agyu el mul haharahu. And as Mefarshim point out, you don't tell a person not to graze somewhere if there's nothing there to graze in the first place. But the point is, it was covered with foliage, it was covered with greenery, and therefore was forbidden for the animals to be there. And so, as a commemoration of the greenery, of the flora of Har Sinai, so we also have greenery in shul. That is the standard, shall we say, or the classic explanation of greenery for Shavuos. Zecher lematan Torah. I must say, I came across another suggestion as to what it is that we are commemorating by putting greenery and such like in shul on Chag HaShavuos. And the source is in the Gemara in Maseches Sota on Daf Yud Beis Amud Beis. There, it discusses the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. We know his mother was able to hide him for a while. There was this decree, Kala Ben Hayilod, Haya Ora Tashlichuhu. All the children, all the males were thrown into the Nile. His mother could hide him for 3 months, but she couldn't hide him anymore. So she put him in this teva, she put him in this little basket, and she set him there on the Nile. And the Gemara points out that a small basket like that does not normally have that much chances of faring well on the Nile. The Nile can flow quite strongly. But then something happened. Rabbi Acha bar Chanina Omar, Osa Hayom Shisha B'Sivan Haya. That day when Moshe was put on the Nile is the 6th of Sivan. How do we figure? Because Moshe is born on the 7th of Adar, which means Adar, then to Nisan, then to Iyar, then to Sivan, at the culmination of 3 months, is actually the 6th of Sivan. Armu malachi asharis lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the malachim petition here. Ribono Shalola, Master of the World, Misha Osid, Lekabel Torah Mihar Sinai, Biyom Zeh. So it's interesting, his life is in danger, but there's already a vision of the future. And this is the day, on this very day, he's going to receive the Torah, on the 6th of Sivan. Yilke Biyom Zeh, so he should come to harm on this day. And that's a very interesting association that, even though we know the numbers, we don't necessarily put them together. Namely, the day that Moshe was put in the Nile, and really on that self-same day taken out of the Nile, was Shavuos. I mean, it was Shavuos 80 years earlier than actually the Torah was given. But the same day nonetheless, and we see the Malachim made that association. One of the great Charonim, Maharam Banet, Rabbi Mordechai Banet, suggests, based on this Gemara, that this is another way of understanding the minhag of putting greenery and shrubbery, because she put in basuf, she put in by the reeds of the Nile. And in fact, therefore, as a zecher for where the whole thing started, even 80 years before the Torah was given, that miracle that Moshe was protected, we commemorate the shrubbery that he was protected in with shrubbery of our own. So that is a second, a very beautiful, actually, interpretation of this, of the minhag of Asavim. We should know that there is another iteration, shall we say, or another application of this minhag, which focuses not so much on shrubbery per se, because so far all we're talking about is grass and greenery. But there is also a minhag, and it's not exactly the same thing, of having flowers on on Shavuos. Now, flowers and greenery, I mean, they come from the same place, but they're not the same thing. So where do flowers come from? And this matter is discussed in a sefer by one of the Sephardi Gedolim of the 1800s. The sefer is called Keter Shem Tov, written by someone called Rabbi Shem Tov Gagin, who was born here in Eretz Yisrael. He ended up in England, actually. And he quotes a sefer, this is not his idea, he quotes Besem Sefer Atik Yomin. I was not able to work out whether Atik Yomin is the name of the sefer, or he's just saying this is a very old sefer. But the source of having flowers on Shavuos is a Gemara in Maseches Shabbos on Daf Peches Omid Beis, commenting on the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which says, Siftotayich Shoshanim, right, your lips are like rose petals. And what's Siftotayich Shoshanim, and how does that relate to the relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem? So the Gemara says, I believe it's Rabbi Shua ben Levi, that when Hashem spoke, and that's Siftotayich, when Hashem spoke, Al kol dibur v'dibur, sheyotza mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with each pronouncement of the Aseres HaDibros, with each pronouncement that came out during that time, Nismale ha'olam kulo besomim, the world was filled with fragrance. And what's the message? The message is that the Dvar Torah should have the same effect on a person as fragrance has. It should uplift the spirits. It should elevate. In the same way that when you smell something fragrant, it puts you in a different state of mind, a different way. Hearing a word of Torah should not just be processed cerebrally. It should also be absorbed emotionally. And that's why the dibros were accompanied by besamim each time. In fact, the Gemara, as is often the case, you have a very heady idea, but the Gemara keeps an eye on the practicalities, as if to say, well, if the fragrance is there after the first dibros, so then what happened in the second dibros? It's already there. But the Gemara explains it was cleared out in between each dibor. The palate of the world, so to speak, was cleared. Through a wind came into, and then it came back again on these 10 occasions. And therefore, says the Keter Shem Tov, in commemoration of the idea that the world was filled with besamim, was filled with this fragrance with every dibur, so we have fragrant flowers. That's where the minhag comes from. Now, in one form or another, the minhag of having either greenery or flowers on Shavuos is older than any of the sources that we've said so far. It can be traced back to, through Chazal, it can be traced back to the times of the Tanakh. How so? In a very interesting way, and this is pointed out by the Chidar Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai in his Perush Birkei Yosef on Orach Chaim. He refers us to the Targum Sheni in Megillas Esther. As we know, there's more than one Targum. Even the Chumash has more than one Targum. It's a number of Targumim. And a famous Targum that accompanies the Megillas Esther is called Targum Sheni. It's rather lengthy. Some people have difficulties with the first one. They haven't yet gotten to the second one. But it really elaborates. And as we know, and in fact, it begins with the Pasuk, and then we'll see the Gemara elaborate somewhat, and the Targum Sheni will elaborate much, much more. And it's actually quite fascinating. It relates to Haman's slander about the Jewish people, which is stated in a rather open-ended way in the Megillah. Their laws are different than everyone else's, or as some explain, their laws are Shonos Mikal Am, an assortment from all the nations. Shonos Mikal Am. Ves Dasi HaMelech Enamasim, but they don't keep your laws. Vela Melechin Shavela Nicham. It's not worth it for you. There's something about them and you. They don't like you. That's really what he's saying. And they're of no use to you. What a thing to say. They're of no use to you. And the Gemara elaborates that what Haman was saying is that, you know, whenever you want to enlist them in something, it's always like a festival for them, or it's always like a Shabbos. It's like it's Shabbos or Pesach or something. Shabbos Hayom, Pesach Hayom. There's always some reason. Okay. But the Targum Sheni says more. The Targum Sheni says that Haman systematically went through all of the Yomim Tovim and he described their customs in the most libelous way. It's quite amazing because the first festival libel really happened with Haman. He described things that happened but gave an interpretation of them which was so anti-monarchy that by the time he's finished, Ahasuerus is convinced that every time they get together in Shul, they're plotting to overthrow him. And in Yanenu, let us see what the Targum Sheni says with regards to Shavuos. Says Targum Sheni, and Haman says, when it comes to the month of Sivan, they make a Yom Tov, they go to their shuls, they read Shema, they daven, they lain, meaning they read the Torah, they read the prophets, and then they curse the king. In other words, the way that he put it, he's describing their davening and says, you know, in the midst of all their davening, there's always a curse there for the king. And they call that day Atzeres, Shavuos. Then, says Haman, they go up to the roof of the shul and they throw out roses. They throw out rose petals to the floor and then they clear them away. And they say, in the same way that we just cleared away all these rose petals, so too all of our meddlesome Gentile neighbors should be cleared away from our midst. It's amazing to see that on the one hand, what he's describing are things that you would see. But the interpretation, anything, everything gets turned into anti-monarchy. Interesting, by the way, the minhag in many places is to bless the monarchy straight after laning. And I wonder whether that's somehow connected to this in response to Haman's saying that they read the Torah, they read the Nevi'im, and then they curse the king. That's actually the point where, as far in our experience, that's the point where we offer a prayer for the king. And maybe that's what he was twisting around. In any case, what we do see is that Haman describes them throwing rose petals from the roof on Shavuos. Now, obviously, his interpretation is of no interest to us because he made it all about getting rid of the Gentiles. But, again, the things that he describes actually happened. His interpretation we discard, but we do see, actually, that this is a source for the practice that even as back as Haman's time, they had flowers in Shul on Shavuos. And we find elsewhere, just parenthetically, but it's important to note, Haman as the most unlikely source you would think for Minhag Yisrael, but there are actually even halachas that we derive from Haman's libel. Strangely enough, he gives this libel about the Jewish people. This is the Gemara says that he says, you know, if a fly falls into their cup, so they scoop out the fly and rinse out the cup and they're good to go. But if a fly falls into the cup, they just scoop out the fly. But if you touch their wine, they throw the whole thing out. Which means they think a fly is you're worse than a fly. So again, that's quite shocking, and obviously what he means to say about that. But in the midst of all of that, says the Rosh, in Maseches Avodah Zarah, we see from here that if a fly falls into the wine, it doesn't trafe up the wine. You just have to scoop it out, and the rest is good to go, leaving aside other considerations. So it's quite interesting that the Rosh, and that's the halacha, the Rosh is prepared to base a halachic ruling on Haman's words. Because again, his interpretation and his conclusions is one thing. But in terms of what he saw, if the Gemara puts it in, so that's taken as accurate. And the Nodi Bihud actually discusses this, because someone asked him, I mean, how can we learn halacha from him? But the Nodi Bihud says very simply that we're not, he's not a posek. Haman isn't passing halachas, but as an accurate depiction of what happened. And thus we see that already from those early times there was a minhag of flowers on Shavuos. Now, there is a third, dare I say it, branch of this minhag. With regards to greenery, so far we've seen grass, which is zeichel matan Torah, flowers, also the fragrance of matan Torah. But there's another section, another subcategory of this minhag. What's left? Trees. The Magen Avraham in Siman Taf Tzadik Dalet quotes a minhag, or brings a minhag, of having trees. Some say branches of trees, others actual proper trees. In Shul, the question is, why would there be trees in Shul? Well, says Magen Avraham, if you look in the Mishnah, in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, you will see that there are different times during the year where different things are judged. On Rosh Hashanah, everyone's judged. On Sukkot, we're judged with regards to water. On Pesach, for produce, wheat and produce. And for Shavuos, Peiros Ha'ilan. Interestingly, in other words, as much as the Rosh Hashanah for trees is Tu Bishvat, but the Yom Hadin for Peiros Ha'ilan is Shavuos. And therefore, says the Magen Avraham, that the day on which it's decided what the produce of the fruits of the trees will be is Shavuos, and therefore they would put trees, I don't know if they're dafka fruit-bearing trees, but trees in the Shul, in order to remind them that they should daven for Peiros Ha'ilan. Very interesting. Now, we don't see that so much. We don't see too many trees in Shul. And one of the main reasons why is because this minhag was opposed by the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, quoted by the Chaye Adam, who in turn is quoted by the Mishnah Berurah, opposed this minhag and says, because you can't have this. Because having a tree at a time of a festival has become such a non-Jewish thing that it actually could in turn become an issue of Chukas HaGoy. As if to say, when you think a tree, when you think festivals and trees, you think of their festivals with their trees. And therefore, says the Vilna Gaon, once that's the case, so then you can't have it in Shul anymore. Now, the truth is that this really touches on, and we will not discuss it in too much detail, but just to see the two sides of the question here, this really touches on a major question as to how to understand what is Chukas HaGoy. Here's the Vilna Gaon saying they have their Kratzbach trees and therefore you can't have a tree on Shavuos, it's Chukas HaGoy. Now, there are those who defend the Minhag, and there were places in Poland and really Kehillas where they continue to have trees out there on Shavuos. But how can you defend it? The defense is based on a ruling of the Maharik, Mahari Kolon, Rabbi Yosef of Kolon, one of the great Rishonim, later Rishonim. And he discusses, and it's quoted by the Ramah, this psak of the Mahari Kolon. He discusses the parameters of Chukas HaGoy. When do you say that something is goyish in our terms to such a degree that it cannot be, that you can't follow it, that you can't do likewise? The question came up because there was a certain locale or region where they made a takona, the Gentiles, that is to say, that anyone who's a doctor needs to wear a special colored clothing. So there were Jewish doctors, of course, that's not a modern invention. There were Jewish doctors there, and so someone wrote to the Rabbi Yosef of Kolon and says, listen, they're saying if you're a doctor, you have to wear the special garment. Is that okay? Are we allowed to do likewise? What about Chukas HaGoy? And the Maharik, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, wrote back and said as follows. Chukas HaGoy is a problem in one of two areas. Either it is a minhag which has no rational explanation at all. It doesn't help anyone. It is not effective in any way, and can't really be explained. That's a problem, because if you can't explain it, who knows what its origins are? And maybe its origins are in Avodah Zarah. So if you can't explain it and you can't see how it's beneficial, readily. That's one branch of chuppas hagoy. Alternatively, says the Ma'arik, if it's something which is either vulgar in nature or promiscuous or something which is antithetical to Torah values per se, that also would be chukas hagoy. Says the Ma'arik, this takana, so to speak, of theirs, is none of the above. The reason why they want doctors to wear distinctive clothing is that they want to be able to identify a doctor as quickly as possible in any given situation. That's the thinking behind it. You can say you don't need it, you do, or maybe you do, but that's what's behind it. It's not in any way touches on either of those problematic areas that we said, and hence it's mutter. That is the analysis of Marie Colon, and it is all quoted by the Rama. And the Vilna Gaon disputes it. But before we get to that, interesting, you see, even back in the times of the Gemara, the collections of these types of practices that one should do or shouldn't do based on imitating the Goyim, the Gemara itself says it depends a lot as to whether it is an effective thing. In fact, the Tosefta discusses various things that they would put by their by the in the farms, by the chickens or what in the coop. The Gemara says to place a staff of wood in the middle of or the side of a chicken coop is forbidden. It's darkei harimori. It's superstitious. It's nothing. And you can't imitate it. But to place a metal stick in the ground, says the Tosefta, is mutter, because it can help you. How does it help you? Could divert lightning. I'm not sure who the discovery of the where lightning is attracted to is accredited to, but it is actually based in the Tosefta, or known in the Tosefta already, that if it's metal, it will draw away the lightning and therefore it's protection of the animals. If it's effective, it's not dark area memory. If it's meaningless, it could be dark area memory. So, however, the Vilna Gaon and the Vilna Gaon is sourced in Tosfos in Maseches Avodah Zarah and Daf Yud Aleph as a much stricter interpretation. That is to say, according to the Vilna Gaon, if it's something that has become a very Gentile practice, in order for it to be mutter, it has to be not only need to have a reason for it, but it has to be sourced in Tanakh. And his reason for saying this is because the Gemara discusses a practice whereby if the king, when the king would pass away, people would burn some of their items. Sorfin al hamalochim. And the question is, what is this? I mean, non-Jews do that. Are Jews allowed to do it? And the Gemara explains that it's permissible. And why is it permissible? Because it's an act of respect, because really what they're saying is that we won't enjoy these things now that this great person isn't here anymore. And the Gemara identifies the source endorsing this practice in Sefer Melachim. Uve misrafos avosecha yisrofu, was said to one of the kings. So you see that it is sourced in Tanakh, the idea that people burn things when a king passes away. Incidentally, and I'm not sure if this is that well known, this is actually the major halachic discussion that accompanies Lag BaOmer. I mean, not saying Tachnun doesn't really take very long to discuss, but what is discussed in the Poskim really in the 1800s, and this actually came before what now has become bonfires, which is a whole thing all on its own, but the it's kind of been phased out the way it originally was. In the 1800s, when it came to Lag BaOmer, people would go to Meron and they would throw valuable things on the fire. And the reason why they did is in fulfillment of this concept of Sorfin al Hamalochim. Because this is the Yorid site of Reb Shimon ben Yochai, and he's the king, as if to say, Man Malki Rabbanan. And so, as far as we're concerned, they're the greats. And that really became the, in the halachic literature, that really was the question. Is it mutter? Is it bal tashchis? Is it sofan al malachim? And all of that is based on this sugya here. People don't burn those sorts of things anymore, at least not on purpose. It's all become bonfires, which is either better or worse, depending. But in any case, says the Vilna Gaon, and this really, if we could just tie everything together here in terms of the chukas hagoy, this is the crux of the matter. Because the Tosa says, you see, It is only acceptable, the Gentiles, they burn their stuff when their king dies. It's only acceptable for us to do it if you can prove it from the Pasuk. If you can demonstrate that it has precedent in Tanakh, which the Gemara did. That's the Tosfos, and the Vilna Gaon adopts that approach. And therefore, there's no source in Tanakh for having trees on Shavuos anywhere. And once it becomes a Gentile practice, in order for us to defend our practice, you need a source in Tanakh. And if you don't have it, so then it shouldn't be there. Whereas the other approach, which is the Maharik and Ramah, as for them, when the Gemara quoted a pasuk, it didn't mean to say that you need a pasuk otherwise it doesn't work. It quoted a pasuk just to explain the rationale. That's all. But you don't need a pasuk. You just need a rationale. And we have a rationale because, as Magen Avraham explained, Rosh Hashanah, Shavuos is the Yom Adin for the fruits of the trees. That's the rationale. It's not in the Tanakh, but it's not for no reason. All you need is a reason. That, if one could summarize, is the machlokas between the Vilna Gaon and the Ramah, which becomes the machlokas Tosfos and Maharik, respectively. In order to have to justify Jews doing something which is seemingly known as a Gentile practice, do you need a pasuk to back it up? For the Vilna Gaon, yes. Or is it enough to have a rationale to explain it for the Ramah? Yes. Interestingly, I wonder whether one could say that perhaps the objection of the Vilna Gaon, if it's based on their trees, so that it would only knock out that part of the minhag, so to speak, namely trees, which actually people don't do anymore. But the shrubbery and the flowers, I mean, they don't have shrubbery and flowers, I don't think. And if it could be that they would be untouched. Interesting to observe, there's many shuls in Yerushalayim, they're called Beit Knesset Hagra, they all have shrubbery and the flowers in them, not that they are necessarily ambassadors for every aspect of Minhag Hagra, but a matter of interest nonetheless. So these are some of the classic discussions that accompany this minhag, and as we see, what's fascinating here is that the minhag itself is divided into three. There's greenery, then there's flowers, and then there's trees, and each one has its own background, and each one has its own course, as it's discussed. And from there, let us move to perhaps some thematic matters that relate to Chag HaShavuos. There is a well-known statement in the Gemara Maseches Shabbos, in Daf Peches, where one of the Amoraim said as follows, Baruch Rechmona, blessed is Hashem, De Yahiv Lanu Uriantli Soi. He gave us a threefold Torah, and really what's going to happen is the number three becomes a very significant number with regards to Torah, in five ways. Number one, he gave us Uriantli Toi, a threefold Torah, namely Torah Nevi'im Ksuvim, and he gave it to us La'amtli Toi, a threefold nation, Kohanim Nevi'im Yisraelim. And that was Al Yidei Tlisoi, through the third child, that's Moshe, there was Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe. B'yerach Tlitoi, in the third month of our leaving Mitzrayim, Nisan Iyar Sivan, B'yom Tlitoi, on the third day of our preparation. So there's a lot of threes there, which means somehow the number three is a very significant number with regards to Torah, but we need to find out why. It is interesting to point out that not all of these threes are the same. Some of these threes are what's known as cardinal threes, that is to say a group of three, and some of them are ordinal threes, namely third in something. The Torah has three parts. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't have three parts. He is part three of his family. But be that as it may, we combine the threes. And the question is, what is the nature of the relationship between the number three, why is it so important? This was like a bracha. What's the bracha? Moving over to another statement in the Gemara, elsewhere in Brachos in Daf Nun Ches, the Gemara takes the pasuk that with which we're familiar, Lecha Hashem Agadula, Agivura, Vatiferes, Vanetzach, Vahahod, and the Gemara associates each of those words with an event, a formative event in our history. And we just take the first three, and that should suffice just for the moment. So starting with the beginning, L'cha Hashem HaGedula, what's Gedula? Says the Gemara, Kriyas Yamsuf. Kriyas Yamsuf was great. V'ha Gevura, what's Gevura? Might, Makas Becheres. Okay, also good. V'ha Tiferes, Zu Matan Torah. That's Matan Torah. And what is Tiferes? Splendor, which means the Matan Torah was a splendid occasion. But once again, we need to try and understand how the word Tiferes becomes a watchword for the giving of the Torah. And we cannot say simply or balabatishly that we're just kind of ticking off the events in order as they happened, and Matantara came third. Because the order has already been inverted between 1 and 2. Number 1 was Kriyas Yamsuf. That came after Makas Bechoros. So Gedula is event number 2. Gevura is event number 1, Makas Bechoros. So we're clear, from the outset, we're not following any chronological order. Rather, it seems to be something more characteristic. And how, therefore, is the word Tiferes characteristic of Matantara? Now, there's a very interesting discussion in the Gemara elsewhere. Maseches Menachos, Kaf Tes Amud Beis. In two places in Shas, the Gemara describes Moshe Rabbeinu ascending to receive the Torah. There's this famous debate with the angels. They want to keep the Torah. He wants to receive the Torah, which we've discussed on other occasions. That's in Maseches Shabbos. But in Menachos, Taf Kaf Tes, the Gemara has something just between him and Hashem. And it describes as he went up to receive the Torah, Hashem just at that moment was tying the crowns, the tagim, which we have on some of those letters, Shatnez Gates, those seven letters in those lines. And Moshe was quite intrigued. What are these crowns? And Hashem said that in the future there will be someone who will expound halachas from these crowns, and that person is none other than Rabbi Akiva. And Moshe Rabbeinu was very intrigued by this person and asked to encounter a Torah discourse of Rabbi Akiva. Hareini Taraso, I'd like to see him in action. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu transported him into the future, and he sat in the back of Rabbi Akiva's shir. I don't know if Rabbi Akiva noticed that Moshe Rabbeinu was sitting in the back. I don't know. But the Gemara doesn't talk about that. But there he is, and he's sitting in the back. And Rabbi Akiva is darshaning, and Moshe Rabbeinu is most impressed. The Gemara there actually says that Moshe Rabbeinu did not know the halachas that Rabbi Akiva was saying. But the truth of the matter is, that's hardly surprising for the simple reason that all of this is happening as Moshe Rabbeinu is just arriving to receive the Torah, which he does over the next 40 days. So if he's just arriving, you don't know the Torah yet. I mean, obviously, with great measure of understanding, talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, 40 days later, who knows what Moshe knows? He's Moshe Rabbeinu. But in any case, at the time, he was very, very taken with Rabbi Akiva. And so much so that he asked Hashem, you know, if you've got someone like that, why are you giving the Torah through me? That's how impressed he was with Rabbi Akiva. I mean, that's a haskama. When Moshe Rabbeinu thinks that you should give the Torah instead of him, that's good. It means you're doing well. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered, he told Moshe to be silent. Kach also b'machshava lefanai. That's what I thought. That's my decision. Don't question it. And now, what is the meaning behind this rather mystifying discussion as to who should give the Torah? As if to say, at the end of the day, you just need someone reliable to give the Torah. Moshe doesn't think he's not reliable. He just to transmit the Torah. So what difference does it make if it's him or Rabbi Akiva? And an explanation, an analysis of this episode in the Gemara, I came across in the writings of Rav Leib Hyman Zatzal, who was the Rav of the Groshul in Beit Vegan. We have quoted from him on a number of occasions, and what we have come to learn is that Rav Hyman is capable of saying chidushim. And that is what's going to happen this evening. And he begins by giving us a bit of a window into Rabbi Akiva. We see that Rabbi Akiva seems to have a very profound appreciation of even things that seem to go wrong, but he understands that that's the way it needs to be. And it comes out sometimes in rather bluntly even. So much so, and I'm not sure if this episode is well known, but the Gemara talks about it in Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Aleph, when his teacher, Rabbi Eliezer, was ill, like very ill. So the Talmidim came to visit, and each of the Talmidim said something in order to raise his spirits. And one of them says, "We need you. You're like the rain. You're like the sun. You're like," and saying how much they appreciated. Along comes Rabbi Akiva, And then when it's his turn, he says, basically, I'm happy that you're suffering. That's what he says to Rabbi Eliezer. Chavivin Yisurin, beloved are Yisurin. That's quite different than what everybody else said. But how could it be? So Rabbi Kiba says, I'll be honest, I was worried, Rabbi Eliezer. Everything always seems to go quite well for you. Your wine never goes sour, and your honey always stays sweet, and your oil never goes rancid. And I begin to wonder whether this is it. Maybe you've received all of schar for all of your mitzvahs and olam hazeh. So now that I see that you're actually in distress, I feel very good. I feel very happy for you. Now that's quite a thing to say to anyone, and it's certainly quite a thing to say to your Rebbe, and moreover to say to him while he's suffering. You can have a discourse about it somewhere far away, but to say it to his face. But that means that Rabbi Akiva absolutely identified with this. And this once again is the famous Rabbi Akiva in the end of Gemara Makkos, when they're walking and they see foxes coming out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim and everyone just falls to pieces. And Rabbi Akiva thinks this is just the best thing that ever happened. And he's laughing and he can see the Geula already. He says, we need this. And this is when he sees retribution, he sees preparation for redemption. I mean, not everyone has that vision. But ultimately, what it means is that Rabbi Akiva fully appreciates the concept of Midas Hadin. Midas Hadin means that the action breeds a reaction, a cause and effect, and it is a positive thing. He appreciates it absolutely and can even rejoice over it. Not many people are like that. It's a certain, it's a combination of a certain approach, but also a certain level. And the truth is, in the end, that's how Rabbi Akiva met his end. I mean, he met a very, very torturous end. And that actually, the Gemara in Menachos, which begins, part one is Moshe hearing a shear from Rabbi Akiva, but then he asks, how does he finish up? And so they kind of fast-forwarded to the end, and Rabbi Akiva's died, he was tortured to death by the Romans, and Moshe Rabbeinu raised the question. Well, a well-known question. Zo Torah v'zu schara. Look at his Torah, and that's his reward. And Hashem's answer to him was exactly the same. Told him to be silent. Kach also b'machshava lefanai. That's what I've decided. And now, that answer, kach also b'machshava lefanai, this is what I've decided, it seems not really to be addressing the question at all. It's just basically saying, you can't understand it, so I don't want to talk about it, and just move on to another topic. But the question is, if you want to move on to another topic, so why did you arrange for Moshe to see you trying the crowns, which would then lead him to ask what they're for, which would then lead you to talk about Rabbi Akiva, which would then lead him to ask his questions, and you say, well, I don't want to talk about it. If you don't want to talk about it, so maybe you shouldn't have been doing something that led him to talk about it. There is a sefer called Toras Chaim from one of the early Acharonim, Rabbi Avraham Chaim Shor, on a number of Masechtas, amongst them Baba Kama, in the fifth perek, the Toras Chaim, and this is quoted by the Shaloh HaKadosh, explains that the words Kach also b'machshava lefanai have a very specific meaning, and Hashem is actually answering the question. The Chumash begins Bereishis bara Elokim es haShemayim es haAretz, and Rashi famously says that originally, Bitechila, because Elokim is a name of Din, Elokim, as opposed to Yudke Vavke, a name of Rachamim, of mercy. So it's all Elokim in chapter 1, because that represents the first thought. Bitechila ala b'machshava, livra es ha'olam b'midas hadin. Hashem's original intention was to create the world with midas hadin. V'ra'a she'ena olam miskayim, that he saw that the world wouldn't last very long. And therefore he twinned it with midas harachamim. And thus we find later on, b'yom hasos, Hashem, Yudke Vavke, Elokim, Eretz, V'Shamayim. Now the question is, what's behind this original thought and then subsequently seeing? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu has infinite knowledge at all times, so then there is no notion of originally thinking and then subsequently reconsidering. But rather, says the Toras Chaim, the original thought is the ideal. The ideal is that the world should be run by Midas Hadin. Because the more things are run by Midas Hadin, the more people earn their reward. The more leeway you give them, the more quarter you give them, so the less they've actually done. themselves. And if a central part of life is about people earning their reward through mitzvahs, so if they're to earn them, so then that's din. The only thing is, pure din is very difficult to abide by. And therefore, practically, you need a mixture of rachamim. But the ideal didn't go away. Because there are some people who can abide by that original level of midas hadin. And one such person is Rabbi Akiva. Which means that Rabbi Akiva, he accepts and he embraces an absolute comeuppance, an absolute accounting and reckoning, and doesn't want to be given any quarter, because he absolutely appreciates midas hadin, and he relates to it, and he that's the way he wants to live his life and to be treated, which even resulted in his own death, which he accepted, and he read Shema b'chol levavecha, and he accepts it. And that's why when Moshe says, but how can that be his end? And what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's answer? Kach ala b'machshava lefonai. Meaning, not just that's what I've decided. This was my original thought. This brings, when Hashem says about Rabbi Akiva, kach ala b'machshava lefonai, he's taking us back to mitchila ala b'machshava livra asa olam b'midas hadin. Rabbi Akiva is a person that can abide by the way that the world was originally meant to be. And that's why this is happening to him. And Rabbi Akiva doesn't want it any other way. And most people aren't like that, but Rabbi Akiva is. Now, thus far, Adkan, and these are already major discussions, Adkan from the Toras Chaim, as quoted by the Shalom, says Rav Hyman, let us not forget that these words, Kach ala b'machshava lefonai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded to both of Moshe's questions in this way. Not only the second question, why was Rabbi Akiva put to death like that? And the answer is, kach ala b'machshava lefonai. The first question also, if you have someone like Rabbi Akiva, why are you giving the Torah through me? The answer was also, kach ala b'machshava lefonai. If it's the same answer, presumably, it means the same thing. And apparently what that means is, that because Rabbi Akiva is someone who lives in the world of din, not only is that the reason why he was put to death in the end, but that's the reason why he can't give the Torah. That's why you're giving the Torah, and not him. He's capable of giving the Torah, that's correct, but he's not the right person. But why not? Because, says Rav Hyman, as surely as HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world now with a combination of din and rachamim, so the Torah is also a combination of din and rachamim. As if to say, the rules and the Torah is the completion of the creation of the world. Which means that the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us reflects the way that the world runs. Namely, not according to strict din. So what's the point? The point is, if the Torah is a Torah which has rachamim in it, which gives people leeway, so then it has to be given by a rachamim person. And interestingly, the Gemara always calls the Torah Rachmana. Rachmana Amar. Torah says, the merciful one says. Because that characterizes the Torah. It's a rule book of Rachamim for a world that Hashem has decided should practically be run with Rachamim. But that's why you need a Rachamim person. Because the whoever gives the Torah is the conduit through which the Torah is transmitted. The conduit has to be appropriate for the nature of Torah as it is. If the Torah was given al-pi-din, with pure din, Rabbi Akiva could give the Torah. But the Torah is given with rachamim, because that's how Hashem wants the world to run, as decided the world should be run, practically. And that's why it's given through Moshe. We see that Moshe has a different approach. When Moshe sees people suffering, he doesn't accept it. He fights against it. He protests it. Lama Hariyosa Lama Zeh, when the Jewish people are in trouble, and Moshe, he wants things to be well for the Jewish people. He's called Raya Mehemna. He is the faithful shepherd. And when Hashem says, Mecheni Nam Sifrecha, Hashem says, Ephraim Rashvidim, Ephraim says, Chalokoi Gadol, I'm going to destroy the Jewish people. Moshe protests. He doesn't say, well, if that's how it needs to be, I mean, that's what they deserve. Midas Hadin says that should be the end of them. But Moshe pushes for Midas Arachamim because he's a Midas Arachamim person. Interestingly, we normally associate Moshe with Din as opposed to Aaron. He is Din and Aaron is Chesed. But it's all relative in the sense that, yes, relative to Aaron, Moshe is din. But relative to Rabbi Akiva, he's not din like that. And Rachamim really is what stands in the middle. Rachamim is a blend of... The Torah has rules. It's not Hefkerus. So where is the Rachamim? That the punishments of the Torah are not as harsh as they might otherwise have been. And in fact, the Shalom HaKadosh goes so far as to say that there is one case where we get a glimpse of what the world would look like if the Torah was given up Yidin, up the original thought. And that's in Parshas Mishpatim, the first of the punitive measures. Ayin tachas ayin. An eye for an eye. That's din. Straight and simple. Now we happen to know it doesn't go like that. Practically, there's drushas, and there's a halacha, and in the end it's money. Which leads us to the question, as we always ask, so there's the question of, as Rav Kupperman phrased it, Sheilat HaKetzad. How do you know that the halacha is not like the simple translation of the words? How do you know that it's not an actual eye for an eye? Okay, the answer is what it is. How do you know that Machros HaShabbos is not Sunday? How do you know it's the second day of Pesach? The answer is what it is. But then the follow-up question is, Sheilat HaMadua. So then why? If the halacha is different than the way that it's said, why is it written differently than what the halacha is? Why not just say, talk about money? Why does the Torah talk about an actual eye? Says the Shalah, here is the, almost like a vestige, or a representation, a sample of what the halacha would look like according to strict din. Strict din says an eye for an eye, and the halacha comes and moves it on. And so, we understand this is the difference between Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Akiva. It's a very, very profound discussion on the part of Rav Chaim. That's why it's so key who gives the Torah, because their different personalities are appropriate for different levels of din versus rachamim as the Torah is given to the Jewish people. And perhaps with this in mind, we can go back to our our Gemaras, our comments, our statements in the Gemara. We have the Gemara which associates, again, L'cha Hashem, HaGedula, V'Gevura, Tiferes. That means that the Gemara sums up the entire giving of the Torah with one word, Tiferes. How? Well, to understand how Tiferes sums up Torah, we need to go back to Gedula and Gevura. Gedula and Gevura represent the attributes of pure kindness and pure justice. Gedula, expansion. Gedula always goes together with Chesed. And Gevura, might, justice. And that's the very reason why the chronological order of the events that are associated with these two words is inverted. What does the Gemara associate with Gedula? Kriyas Yamsuf, because it was an absolute act of kindness that Hashem did to split the sea open for us. That was the focus of Kriyas Yamsuf, just to move it out of our way so that we'd have safe passage. That's outstanding kindness. That embodies Gedula. What about Gevura? The apex of Gevura, Makas Bechoros, just like that. They were all wiped out. And then that leads us to Tiferes. Tiferes, which is the third of the attributes, the splendor of Tiferes is the blending of these two attributes, which is called Rachamim. Then, in fact, Rachamim is not like Chesed, it's an in-between stage. And it has aspects of both. It is quarter, you're given patience, you're given time, you're given, but there are still rules. But the rules are made more workable. It's not absolute justice, but it's not chaos. And that's Tiferes. And that's how the Gemara sums up the giving of the Torah. Because the giving of the Torah itself is Tiferes for us. It's a mix, it's the blend, it's Rachamim. The Torah is to us what Rachamim is to the world. And perhaps with this in mind, we can understand why the number 3, going back to our other comment, is such a central number for Matan Torah. It's the third month, and it's got 3 parts, and Moshe's the third child, and we're a threefold nation. It's threes all over the place, and it's like this outstanding brocha. Why? Because the bracha is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah. It's in the sense that three dominates the Torah, because the Torah is Tiferes, which is the third of those attributes. It's neither one extreme nor the other, but a third thing. It's neither Gedula or Gevura. It's Tiferes. It's neither Chesed or Din. It's Rachamim. And therefore, because it is that third attribute, and that's the Torah as we have it, that's why the number three is such a motif number within Torah. There is an irony here, and that is, we then have the Torah, what we call D'oraisa, orientally, sorry. But then we have something called D'rabbanon. Now, what do the Rabbanon do? The Rabbanon, they expand, and they protect, and they add all these things just to make sure, shouldn't even... And interestingly, from a certain point of view, it could be that what the Rabbanons, and sometimes the Rabbanon, they raise the level of stringency. Not only that you shouldn't cook meat and milk together, you shouldn't even eat them together, you have to even need to wait. They expand the level of stringency of many things. Perhaps they expand the level of stringency closer to the way the Torah would look had it been given through Rabbi Akiva. In other words, if we imagine a Torah which is din, so it could be the halakhas would be stricter. But what does that look like? That's what happens when the Rabbanon add their measures. They make the halakha stricter. They actually bring it closer to the way a din Torah would look like. A Torah of din would look like. And it's interesting that the one who is credited with training and raising all of those that would continue to transmit the oral Torah, of which Dinim Drabbanon is a major part, is Rabbi Akiva. All of the bodies of Halacha, as we know, are all from Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, in the sense of the ones who organize them. He's behind all of them, as the Gemara says in Sanhedrin and Dach Pei Vav. The Mishnayos, Rastam Mishnah, Rabbi Meir, and the Teras Kohanim is Rabbi Huda, and the Sifrei is Rabbi Shimon, and so on and so forth. The Sefer is Rabbi Nechemiah, the Chulu Alibad Rabbi Akiva. So there's an amazing situation here, because Rabbi Akiva yet became a transmitter of Torah. Not the Chamisha Chumshe Torah, and not Din D'Oraisa, but he became the transmitter for Dinim D'Rabbanon, and that, in a sense, is more in keeping with the halacha as it would be if Rabbi Akiva was the one to transmit the Torah. But what's the irony? The irony is, because the Torah is Rachmana for us, so any extra measure is considered beyond the letter of the law. And because it's beyond the letter of the law, it actually brings about a response of chesed from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because that's midah keneged midah. Midah keneged midah is, if you keep the law, Hashem keeps the law for you. If you go beyond the letter of the law for Hashem, Hashem goes beyond the letter of the law for you. That's the famous Gemara in Brachos and Daf Kaf, where the angels asked, how can you favor the Jewish people? It says, you don't favor anyone. But then you say, Yisar Hashem panav elecha, Hashem should favor you. How can you favor them? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu famously answered, how can I not favor them? They favor me. What does that mean? How do we favor Hashem? They favor me because I've written the Torah, ve'achalta v'savata uveirachta. I only require them to bench if they've had a full meal, they've eaten to satiation. And look at them. They're benching, they had a kazayas, they had a kabetza, they're already benching. I didn't ask them to do that. That's above and beyond. That's beyond the letter of the law. So if they favor me, if they go beyond the letter of the law for me, I'm going to go beyond that law for them. That's midah keneged midah. But the irony is that all of those extra measures, in pure terms, they could have been din. It's only rachamim that lowers the bar, so to speak. Which means that if you raise the bar again, closer to what would have been din, it's then called chesed, and brings about a reaction of chesed. That's the amazing situation here. So there is certainly a great deal to think about in terms of this discussion, and it brings in line, as it does, so many fascinating statements of Chazal, which otherwise might be somewhat opaque. Why is Tiferes Matan Torah? Why is number three so important for Matan Torah? I'll just conclude in the final two or three moments by referring to the fourth drasha in the Gemara. Shavuos is finished, but it's a shame not to mention what we're about to mention, and once we do, you'll see why. Agadula, Agivura, Atiferes, Vahanetzach. What is Netzach? Says the Gemara, Vahanetzach, Zo Yerushalayim. That's Netzach. That's the eternal city of the Jewish people. And that came forth. And I would like just to close with a quote, actually, from Rav Menachem Zemba. Hashem Yikom Domo. If you've heard of Rav Menachem Zemba, he was famously one of those in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he supported the uprising. There was a machlokas at the time. It wasn't clear. These are very, very thorny issues. No one really... It's not so clear-cut in terms of the consequences, but he supported it. And this is taken from an address that he gave to the Knesia Gedola of the Gedolei Torah there in 1937. And he comments on this statement of Gemara. Va'tiferes zu matan Torah, va'netzach zu Yerushalayim. And these were his words. Ha'am Yisraeli, the Jewish people, tif'arto v'hadro, what is its splendor? May omitz libo u'gevuras nishmaso, with all of its strength and heroism, hitkala b'chol mahuso v'atzmuso le'enei kala olam, b'yom simchas libo shel tiferes zo matan Torah. The Jewish people emerge on the world scene as the power that they are on the day of matan Torah. V'kohu gam tiferes Yisrael b'chol hayomim. That is their splendor in all places, in all times, b'chol hayomim, b'chol makomos, in all places. What makes the Jewish people splendid is the Torah. Ki ach barak ayidei sha'anu ein lanu ela Torah achas na'aseinu legoi echad ba'aretz. The Jewish people only really achieve unity in the land when they have the Torah. That's where you say ata echad b'shimcha echad is the Torah. U'mika amcha Yisrael goi echad ba'aretz. If they're in line with ata echad b'shimcha echad, that makes them goi echad ba'aretz. And why do we praise the holy land? What's the best thing we can say about it? We say Ein Torah, Ketorah Eretz Yisrael. And what do we say about Yerushalayim? Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. That's how we depict the centrality of Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim. And therefore, says Rav Nachum Zemba, important to note, Yerushalayim has been mentioned within the context of its greatness. V'samchu Chachamim, the Chachamim attached Tiferes and Netzach. Va'Tiferes du Matan Torah. The first thing is the splendor of Matan Torah. Va'Netzach is Yerushalayim. And then the eternity of Yerushalayim. Kilomar. His concluding words. Kilomar, as if to say, Im nis ametz lachzik v'la'amol. If we invest and exert ourselves, She'yichai v'kayim Tiferes Yisrael, she Matan Torah. If we invest in the splendor of Yisrael, which comes first, Matan Torah, Az nikaveh ki be'ezos Hashem yiskayim netzach Yisrael v'tikvaso shua netzach zu Yerushalayim. That's one. It is not merely chronological. It's causational. What gives us hope for v'netzach zu Yerushalayim is investing in and surrounding Tiferes zu Yerushalayim. Asher shami yiskalav yiskadosh shemo shel Kadosh Baruch Hu le'netzach netzachim. Very special words. Dover be'ito matov. We wish you all a Chag Sameach, a good Yom Tov, and we'll meet again with Hashem next Monday.